every village will probably take on water this year, just because there's that much water in the system.
Waters rise in Kuskokwim River villages, downriver from Akiak. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 11th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study looks at whether fish feel pain.
This result really disproves that all fish responses to pain are reflexes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world.
Lower Kuskokwim villages are being inundated with high water since an ice jam released below the village of Akiak this morning. School was canceled in five villages near Bethel because of high flood water. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
High floodwaters that had been surrounding nearly all buildings and covering nearly all roads in Akiak started to go down. Akiak elder Moses Owens.
The water that was in front of the school has receded. It's bare ground now, but some of the roads are washed out. Some of the roads are still underwater.
While waters were going down in Akiak today, they started to rise in villages downriver of Akiak. Floodwaters in Queethluk rose slowly over the weekend, but have started to rise faster today. Queethluk Mayor David Epchuk says that about 60% of the homes are now surrounded by water, some as deep as 3 feet.
Currently, there are people being evacuated by boat for community school. And they're actually driving very slow, cautiously, not to disturb buildings that are surrounded by water. We're asking our evacuees to bring along dry food with sleeping gear.
Epchuk asked the Queethluk City Council to declare a disaster emergency because the road leading to Queethluk Airport has been washed out.
All of our commercial flights to and from the community are basically suspended because people cannot go to the airstrip. The road is washed out.
Epchuk says a few of the elderly that require medical attention were evacuated from Queethluk over the weekend before the airport road washed out. Over in Akichuk, resident Frank Chingliak says that water has been rising there this morning.
I'm a little bit worried about my mechanics, where all my freezers are, you know.
The main road to the Akichuk school is underwater. Chingliak says people have prepared for flooding in his neighborhood, which is a lower area of town.
My neighbor has a ladder for his boardwalk, makeshift ladder. And for me, I have a couple boats here in front of my house, so we planned accordingly. And hopefully we wouldn't have to use the boats, but they're ready to be used just in case.
On Friday, Akiak residents were evacuated to the school. Nearly 40 people in the village, elders and small children, were evacuated out of Akiak altogether. The Akiak school, the airport, and the road between the two places is on higher ground than other areas in Akiak, so most residents were allowed to stay. About 100 stayed that weekend in the school. Ben Bach, a hydrologist with the National Weather Service, says over the next few days there will still be minor to moderate flooding in downriver Kuskokwim villages.
Every village will probably take on water this year just because there's that much water in the system. Even below this little flood surge coming down from Akiak, water levels were bank full or already above bank full in the Kuskokwim. So there's going to be at least minor flooding for every village.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
On the Yukon River, Stevens Village is the latest community to be flooded. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says yesterday's flooding at Stevens Village resulted when a 35-mile-long ice jam formed downstream from where the Yukon flows under the bridge on the Dalton Highway.
That jam extended all the way up to Stevens Village and caused flooding. The last report is that all the homes in there had water in them. Even the house on the highest ground in the village had water in it.
Plum says the village's airstrip and school, which sit on even higher ground, were spared flooding, as was the village beaver upstream. Both villages had evacuated women, children, and elders in anticipation of trouble Friday and Saturday. Plum says the jam released downstream of the Yukon River Bridge around 1 this morning, relieving concerns about extremely high water and ice at the bridge and pipeline crossing.
The level of the ice actually had risen to, this is unofficial reports, its highest level anyone has ever seen at the Yukon River Bridge. Within 10 feet of going over the portion of the piers that are made to deflect river ice and water. So the pipeline and DOT were concerned about if it rose above that level, they'd have to shut down, or they were concerned they might have to shut down the pipeline and the bridge.
Plum says the breakup front is now downstream of the bridge, past the village of Rampart. He says Rampart sits on very high ground and is not likely to see any flooding if the ice jams again. He says there are a number of fish camps and cabins that could be impacted along this stretch, where a flood warning remains in effect. Meanwhile, Plum says there's another breakup front that's caused high water even farther down the Yukon at Ruby.
That's because we've got some large tributaries coming in that had broken up earlier, including the Tanana River, the Tozitna, the Melozitna, and also the Koyukuk. So that was pumping a lot of water into the Yukon and causing sort of a secondary breakup occurring farther downriver.
Plum says there was no flooding at Ruby, but water did back up and threaten cabins in the vicinity of the village. State emergency managers at Eagle have set two immediate priorities following last week's record flood that hammered the community's waterfront and severed the transportation, power, and communication links with the native village upstream of the city. Al Cavallo with the State Department of Emergency Management says opening up the road from Eagle to the native village is the first challenge.
There's about a mile and a half of large ice boulders, blocks. DOT is going to contract the work out, and they are working on the contracting right now and working on getting some folks to come out here. We're hopefully going to expect them here within the next couple of days.
Cavallo says restoring power and telephone to the native village are also high priorities. He says local provider Alaska Power and Telephone is looking at bringing in a generator to serve the village until transmission lines between the village and the city power plant can be repaired.
A large enough generator out there that they can actually tap in to the existing grid and at least run some power that way to the community. And in addition, AP&T is also going to run some phone line, through the woods or whatever it's going to take in order to gain some phone access with them as well.
Cavallo says the Eagle Village projects are happening as the larger community transitions from the initial life safety issues of last week's flood.
We're looking at feeding people, housing people, in the interim. And then, once the immediate needs are met like that, then you start gravitating towards a recovery process.
Cavallo says the recovery will include individual assistance of up to $5,000 for families that suffered property damage and public assistance funds to repair infrastructure. Tribal entities and nonprofit groups, including the Red Cross, are working with the state to manage all aspects of the response, including temporary housing, meals, and the distribution of donated goods like food and clothing. The state reports that the National Guard is trucking four 400-gallon water tanks to Eagle. The city well and many individual wells have been contaminated by flooding. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an ocean ranger reports improvements in the cruise ship monitoring program.
We had a suggestion sheet that we sent in. In that manual, there were several suggestions I made, and I saw every one of them in there this year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
A crew member aboard the Royal Caribbean ship Serenade of the Seas has what Alaska's chief medical officer is calling a probable case of H1N1 virus, the so-called swine flu. Dr. Jay Butler said yesterday that the case is being called probable because although the crew member did test positive for the H1N1 virus in Seattle, the testing methods are new emergency protocols, which must be confirmed by the CDC. Washington state officials expect that confirmation this week. Butler says the ship is traveling through icy straits right now and will be docking in Sitka in the next few days.
The crew member became ill on May 2nd and was tested while the ship was in port in Washington state. This person was placed in isolation in her quarters, completed a course of antiviral medications, and is doing well.
Butler says the crew member has not had a fever for more than 3 days and tested negative for H1N1 in Ketchikan. Butler says this probable case is not a surprise, but rather a confirmation that this virus causes illness similar to seasonal influenza.
But is also transmissible like seasonal influenza and has now been confirmed in 43 states, also in the District of Columbia, and in 28 other countries than the United States.
Butler says Royal Caribbean has been taking measures to prevent the spread of illness, and people who have had close contact with the crew are being monitored.
At this time, we have no new reports of probable H1N1 influenza linked to this crew member or this cruise ship, or in fact, at this time, anywhere in Alaska.
Butler says Washington state has more than 100 confirmed cases of H1N1 influenza. He says state officials reported their first death from the virus on Saturday. Butler says more information is available at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. The Interior Department has a huge influence in Alaska. It controls most of the land in the state and oversees wilderness, national parks, and oil and gas leases. Its agencies include the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Fish and Wildlife Service. So the job of the Interior Secretary's Special Assistant on Alaska Issues also has a far reach. Kim Elton took the Washington-based job this winter, leaving Juneau, which he'd represented in the Alaska legislature for 15 years. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, Elton is adjusting to the new job.
Kim Elton has been on the job at the Interior Department for 6 weeks and says every day issues come at him from every direction of the compass.
We're a huge land manager in the state of Alaska, and the decisions that the leadership team makes affect every nook and cranny of almost every Alaskan's life. And we hear about it.
Elton says it's a balancing act, working on what he calls the legacy issues and things that crop up. In recent weeks, he's focused on breaking events, including flooding on the Yukon River and the National Park Service response to Mount Redoubt's volcanic activity. Elton says the legacy issues are the big picture decisions the administration wants to be remembered for.
I do think the secretary has been very, very clear on what he is going to focus on. Energy. Not just, renewable energy, but the energy that we now rely on and depend upon as we work toward a more renewable energy future. I think he is very, very focused on building future capacity by involving young people in the challenges of resource management. And what he calls our treasured landscapes.
Elton says treasured landscapes include the national parks set aside by previous administrations over which the current one has stewardship. In that respect, Elton says the Interior Department needs to balance economic development with being a good custodian. He says it's too soon to say exactly what the Interior Department's goals are, since Secretary Salazar is still working on filling some top jobs.
So it's easy to identify pragmatism, and it's easy to identify a teamwork ethic, but because we don't have the team in place, it's difficult to say, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z right after we do A, B, and C, because those are decisions that have to be made by the team when it's completed.
One of the possible team members, an Interior Deputy Secretary, has had his confirmation held up by Senator Lisa Murkowski. She's awaiting answers from the Interior Department about her complaints over a lack of aggressiveness on oil and gas issues. In the last few days, Alaska's congressional delegation has signed on to letters to Secretary Salazar urging action on the current offshore drilling plan. It received a heavy blow last month by the D.C. District Court of Appeals, which said the government did not conduct an adequate analysis of environmental sensitivities and halted lease sales. The Alaska delegation wants to know how the Interior Department plans to respond, if it will pull together an acceptable environmental analysis, and when. Elton says that question is being worked through.
It is an issue that is before the courts, and there have to be some legal decisions made, and those decisions are still being vetted and sifted through, and T's are being crossed and I's are being dotted. But clearly it's an issue that we have to get beyond, because there are so many questions out there that industry has to deal with and that we have to deal with.
Elton says one lesson the new Interior Department staff learned from the last administration was not to rush decisions or policies. He says they've had to deal with the aftermath of decisions made in the final days of the Bush administration.
I mean, a large part of our first 100 days has been dealing with issues that have been dumped back in our lap for procedural reasons. And I would just note some of them are the recent OCS decision by the three-judge panel here at the D.C. District Court, guns in the parks, and just several other issues that the lesson I think that the secretary is really trying to enforce is, you know, it's hard to move ahead, you know, when somebody keeps kicking you back.
Elton says at this point, the Interior Department's goal is to apply policies in the way Congress intends, so their plans don't stall out. He says they're also trying to communicate effectively with stakeholders, from industry officials to environmentalists to Alaskans. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A new study shows that fish feel pain and react to it, as many mammals do, by being more cautious. KUCB's Ann Hillman has more.
Assistant Professor of Animal Science Joseph Gardner and his graduate student Janneke Nordgren developed an experiment with goldfish at Purdue University. They attached miniature heaters to the sides of the fish and slowly heated them up. Half of the fish were given morphine beforehand, and half were given saline.
The drugs did not really change their response to that heat stimulus when it was given to them.
All of the fish reacted reflexively and wriggled around trying to get away from the heat, much like a person who moves their hand from a hot stove. But Gardner says the most unexpected results came when the fish were put back into their home tanks much after the experiment was over.
The fish that had received morphine were just sort of, you know, swimming around being goldfish. And the goldfish that had received saline, which had received the placebo, were hovering on the bottom of the tank, being very, very still, which are these sort of defensive, wary behaviors.
Gardner explains that this indicates that fish don't just react robotically to pain and try to avoid it. It actually indicated that they process the pain cognitively, just as people do.
Fish actually experience something. And that experience over time got translated into something perhaps like anxiety or fearfulness that was expressed behaviorally as this sort of defensive behavior back in the home cage. And the reason that this is so important is that it can't possibly be a reflex, because a reflex is specific to the stimulus that occurred.
The fish that received morphine didn't have the same reactions because the drug numbed their experiences of the pain. Like all science, the experiment doesn't prove anything, but...
And this result really disproves that all fish responses to pain are reflexes. It disproves that.
Though the experiment was only conducted on one species of fish, Gardner says that he doesn't think it only shows that goldfish can feel pain.
I think that pain is one of the most basic experiences that an animal can have. Pain, fear, hunger, and I find it pretty implausible that a single species would feel pain and the rest of the similar group of animals wouldn't. I find that very hard to believe.
He says this might have serious implications for how humans interact with fish.
If fish can experience pain, then there are ways of slaughtering fish which are going to be extremely painful. And there are ways of slaughtering fish which would be virtually painless. And so I think it behooves us to know whether that's an important distinction to make or not. It's just a matter of sort of ethical responsibility to the animals which we interact with.
Gardner says he hopes to continue this type of research with other species. In Onalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska's legislature left a lot of unfinished business when it adjourned last month. Energy development, student loan forgiveness, and other issues will be back on the table when lawmakers resume meeting next January. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld talked to members of Southeast's legislative delegation about their priorities and has the story.
The region's lawmakers worked this year on a funding mechanism for power generation and transmission projects. Bills in the House and Senate proposed reworking an existing Southeast Energy Fund to help pay for lines and dams. Both made significant progress, but Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman says the time wasn't right.
We worked those bills to the finance committees, both in the House and the Senate, and they will be on the table with other energy bills and energy needs around the state. The concern that a lot of us in Southeast, from a Southeast legislative perspective, is that we want to make sure that the region's in position when the heavy discussion comes down on an in-state bullet line, which would serve gas from the North Slope into the rail belt.
At least $1.5 billion in projects have been proposed for the region. Stedman says he'll pursue his Senate legislation next year. So will Haines Republican Representative Bill Thomas, who introduced the House version. Thomas was among the Southeast lawmakers backing bills to reduce loans of college students who return to the state.
We're educating our children, and they're leaving Alaska. I want them to come home, and so do other people.
Thomas introduced a measure repaying loans for teachers, fisheries biologists, dentists, and nurses. It didn't pass, but he did insert language in another student loan bill that made it through. The wording tells loan managers to come up with a plan.
The Student Loan Corporation shall develop a proposal for the state program under which the state would repay all or part of loans to students for costs of post-secondary education.
And is that just for the occupational groups you were looking at before, or for everyone?
It's programmed for post-secondary, which should be everybody.
Thomas says that will help consideration to continue next year. Juneau Democratic Representative Beth Kurtula introduced her own bill for giving up to half of loans owned by all students who return to the state. She says time did not allow her to pursue that bill this year.
As minority leader, I have duties that go beyond my own personal legislation. And the day that Senator Elton left, I looked around at my staff, who largely do caucus work as well as my own personal legislative work, and we all, as a team, decided there was absolutely no way I could move personal legislation this session.
Another Southeast lawmaker's bill attempted to prohibit nurses' mandatory overtime. Wrangell Republican Representative Peggy Wilson, herself a nurse, says too many hours stresses healthcare workers, threatening patients' well-being. But most hospitals oppose the bill, saying it's not needed and could lead to staff shortages. Wilson says she hopes to move the measure next year.
We might work on it a little bit in the interim and see if we can come up with some compromise language that both sides can be happy with.
One Southeast lawmaker has no leftover bills. That's Juneau Democrat Dennis Egan, appointed the last day of the session to fill a vacant Senate seat. Egan says he'll try to push legislation through his chamber that Juneau's representatives, Republican Kathy Munoz and Democrat Kurtula, got through the House.
One of the big concerns for me is the Mental Health Lands Trust building in the old subport area, and starting to work and meeting with different legislators on trying to make sure that this is tackled the first part of the session.
Lawmakers are in the midst of a two-year session. That means bills left over at the end of the first year stay in play during the second. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The first ocean ranger to go public says the environmental monitoring program is improving. In a press event held last week, the Department of Environmental Conservation granted rare access to one of the 25 full-time rangers. Morris Mickelson monitors compliance with state and federal environmental requirements and ensures proper sanitation, health, and safety practices. Mickelson is a 17-year veteran of the maritime industry and a 2-year veteran of the Ocean Ranger program.
Well, you know, it improved a lot from last year. We had a suggestion sheet that we sent in, and in that manual there were several suggestions I made, and I saw every one of them in there this year.
Mickelson had requested more maps in the Ranger's manual, including detailed depictions of dock areas and of Alaska waters. He says both have helped identify what DEC Cruise Ship Program Manager Denise Koch calls mystery sheens.
The most numerous concern that was forwarded to us during the 2008 season by Ocean Rangers had to do with oil. Many of those oil instances were characterized as mystery sheens, so sheen in the harbor, and wasn't clear whether it was coming from cruise ships or other vessels in the area.
Ocean Rangers reported 13 oil sheen cases to DEC in 2008. They reported 74 oil cases in total. Koch says that cruise ships reported just 14 instances of oil. The Rangers are riding aboard 81% of large cruise ships in Alaska waters in 2009. In 2008, they rode a total of 456 voyages. Mickelson says crew members gave him the cold shoulder on his first cruise last year, but they eventually warmed to him.
Things really loosened up well, and really I don't feel any access problems now. And it seems more relaxed, frankly, on the ships towards us.
Denise Koch says DEC can't afford to put Ocean Rangers on all ships since the department has to purchase a berth for each ranger. Ships without full-time rangers receive in-port inspections. DEC says it plans to allow more time for these import visits during the 2009 season. Chip Toma co-authored the 2006 cruise ship initiative that led to the Ocean Ranger program. He says he is satisfied with the program so far.
We have in every case a qualified, licensed marine engineer who's familiar with ship systems, and I think that's a real important aspect of this program. Because of that, I think the program's working well, and I wish them success for 2009.
DEC has contracted with Crowley Marine Services to manage the Ocean Ranger program for 2 years. The cost of the contract is approximately $4 million for the 2009 cruise season, the same as last year. The program is funded by a $4 per berth charge. Only one Alaskan candidate qualified and worked as an Ocean Ranger during the 2008 season. There are no Alaskan Ocean Rangers at this time, but DEC and Crowley are discussing strategies for recruiting more Alaska-based applicants. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Ed Schoenfeld and Rebecca Shear in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.